Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. Today my guest is Simon Scarrow, one of Britain's best-loved historical fiction writers. The 20th book in his Eagles of the Empire series will be out in November. But today we're going to talk about his new thriller, Blackout, which is set in wartime Berlin. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM, Simon. Lovely to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
That's brilliant. We're going to discuss Blackout and some of the issues that come up around the book, but I thought we'd start with a few basic questions, if you don't mind. Did you always want to write?
I suppose in short, yeah. I always wanted to be a storyteller of some kind or other, and writing seemed a logical one. But I started out by just telling stories to guys at school, really, in the dormitory at night.
Mm-hmm.
And went reasonably well, so I got the job full-time.
Yeah. Is it important, do you think, to have another career, though? Something else, you know, as sort of a hinterland, if you like.
I think it's vital for very, very pragmatic reasons, really. When I first got published, of course, every writer's dream is that you write the first book, it's a runaway international bestseller.
Mm.
And you don't have to worry about money ever after. My agent soon put me right on that one. And she said, don't give up the day job. And I had shortly after being published, I went to History in Action, which is something that English Heritage used to run.
Yeah.
And met Bernard Cornwell there. We were chatting about this. And he said, you'd be a loony if you gave up your day job until you got at least 5 books solidly commercially successful under your belt, and only then start thinking about it. So I took that to heart and basically carried on writing and teaching. And it seemed like, you know, it seemed to work out quite well as a balance until Headlines said, could you write 2 books a year? And then that's when the stress started.
Mm.
And I was having lunch with a writer mate of mine, Chris Humphreys, and mm-hmm. he said, I was just talking about the stress, and he said, well, why don't you take a break from teaching? And I said, no, I can't. You know, teaching's the job, writing's the hobby. And he said, well, how much are you earning from each? And so I told him, and he went,
you've answered your own question, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you write historical novels. Was that your interest as a reader? I suspect, actually, your interests are much wider than that, but what do you like reading?
Well, to be honest, the first 3 novels I wrote, gathering dust in a drawer in my desk, one of those was a sort of apocalypse survivor's story.
Mm.
One was a detective novel, and the other was a comedy.
Right.
I really didn't have much idea about historical fiction, you know, being where I would actually enjoy any success. I only got into that because I discovered Lindsay Davis, and I was also a big fan. I mean, I've been a big fan of historical fiction from the outset. It's just that it didn't occur to me to become a historical fiction writer until quite late in the day. And I thought, well, what I really want to read is something like Lindsay's bottom-up view of the Roman Empire.
Right, yes.
But featuring something, you know, but in a military context.
Mm.
And at the time, there was nothing there. All the books on Rome seemed to be about generals and emperors and so on. And I thought, well, I'll write this one for me.
Mm.
And sat down and got started and quite liked the first few chapters and then tried it on an agent. And they said, that's great. You know, where's the rest of the book? And I had to sort of say to them, well, you know, the rest of the book is actually still in the pen. So you're going to have to wait.
And that was Under the Eagle. Is that the one we're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it's called The Recruit initially.
Right. Yeah, well, that's what Cato is in the book. Actually, that's where I first caught up with your books, was the beginning of that series. Yeah. But just to be a little bit more general for a second, of course, you wrote that series, and that's been a long-running series with Cato and Macro. But you also wrote about the Napoleonic era, and we're going to be talking about your book, which is set during the Second World War in Nazi Germany. So, I mean, you don't want to be typecast, obviously, but do people sort of think that you write one thing, whereas actually you're more interested in history as a subject, aren't you, rather than just sort of one specific era?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, history was the big love at school. And actually, when you mentioned this is a long-running series, I'm just 20th is about to come out in November.
Right.
This one I'm dedicating to my old history teacher at school, a guy called Jonathan Mills, who I very recently got in touch with again. And it's quite a, you know, one of these things, one of his kids said, oh, I think my dad taught you at school.
So all right.
Chatting. And I said, John Mills, you know. And so this is my thank you to him, really, because he was an absolutely brilliant teacher and passed on his love of history to me and all the guys in the class. And it's not just Rome. It's the whole kind of gamut of history. I think partly that's down to the first school I went to in England when I got back here, where the history teacher started with the Big Bang and worked his way forward chronologically. So we kind of didn't get to people until the end of the second year. You know?
That's a new take on it, I must admit. Interestingly, though, of course, I think research is a really important part of your book. So I want to just cover some issues around this, you know, history in general, sort of a sense, before we get to your book. But so let's start with research, because it's obviously a fundamental. I'm wondering how you go about it, just to explain a little bit about that for people to start with.
Well, there's obvious things, you know, you go to the historical studies of periods. There's a wealth of stuff on the internet, of course. If you're writing about a particular era, you want to get sort of detailed, real nut, you know, bitty details on uniform and things like that.
Right.
Actors are people to talk to because you know, they know, for example, I had got a wrong version of a Walter pistol.
Right.
Some guy said, no, that version didn't come out until such and such. And you think, well, that's useful to get right.
Mm.
So you've got all of those things. And then there's another side to it, which I think is equally important, which is if you can possibly do it, walk the ground where the novel is set.
Right.
Because you know, to get a feel of the place, you know, Germany, for example, is much colder and clammier than a British city.
Mm.
And if you're writing about the desert in Egypt, you know, the heat there gets to sort of in, you know, late 30s, early in the morning, and then rises from there, you know. So these are things that are worth knowing, and you really can't substitute going there. And you can't just kind of read Lonely Planet or some sort of online guide, tourist guide to a place, and get the same sense of what the temperature feels like, what the air, you know, because where there's no moisture, for example, in Wadi Rum, you can see for miles, you know, crystal clear, pin sharp. So, you know, it's things.
Yeah, and you'd never realize a detail like that unless you actually went there and you experienced it for yourself. Yeah, I see that. So obviously, it's very different, too, because when you talk about writing a book about 2,000 years ago, you know, or you're writing a book about actually only 80 years ago, there's an awful lot more information. I mean, you mentioned earlier about starting history with the Big Bang. We have a kind of concept of history, don't we, about as what is documented. And of course, there's an awful lot more documented about the modern period than the later period.
Well, I sometimes wonder if history is actually going to be viable as a discipline for much longer, because it's kind of like a funnel. So, you know, the further back in history you go, it's narrow. And then as it kind of, as we get more towards the modern age, of course, now it's kind of like that, you know, with all the amount of data that's generated and stored each year is phenomenal. You know, it's just exploding. Yes. So where does a historian start now? You know, if you're looking at, particularly if you're looking back at, say, 2, 3, 4 years ago, in 20 years' time, a historian looking back to now, you know, you're just going to be drowning in the data.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I spoke to a journalist the other day who was saying that she was covering the American election for Obama. And by the time it had got to the election for Trump, you couldn't keep the information that was coming out in your mind. You know, you couldn't have a grasp of everything, whereas she felt sort of under Obama that you could. And of course, as you say, even if you tell personal stories, as you do with Cato Macro, for instance, which is very small stories in a sense, even if you expand this definition of history to include that kind of ordinary field of people, you're still talking about a phenomenal level of information, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Right. So given that, the question then is, when you write your historical novels, how do you actually interpret that or funnel that into a novel, if you like?
You can do a lot of reading on the broader context. It's always good to, you know, you need to know what's going on historically
Yeah.
When your characters actually are in the story that you're dealing with. And you often pick up quite it's not just a broad historical stream that's sort of passing behind them. You also, in the more personal accounts of historical era, you pick up a lot of small details. So, for example, eyewitness accounts of living through Berlin in the Second World War mention things that you really wouldn't have thought about. For example, I didn't know, for example, the Germans at the time, the traditional Christmas dish was fish, and you kept the fish in your bath for the last few days before Christmas, before you cooked it. Now, that's a kind of a detail that a German at the time would know instinctively, and very few people
bother recording
it. It's only when someone mentions it in passing, you think, I want to make this thing feel right. We'll make sure we drop that one in. And of course, the more you seed a story with these little tiny bits of information that people have no clue about, in the broad understanding of a historical era, the more you give it that kind of three-dimensionality and you flesh out the reality of the world around the characters that you're writing about. And for me, history is always from the bottom up. That's basically my take on all the historical novels I've done. I know I've written about Wellington and Napoleon, and I kind of wish I had known what I got in, was getting into before I started, because if you're doing it from the top down, you're far more constrained by facts than the availability.
Yes, right.
And also, there's just so much material to get through. I mean, when I blithely signed up the contract for the Wellington Napoleon series, I then discovered that there were over 100,000 biographies of Napoleon. I thought, I'm not going to be reading all of those.
No, for that one little detail that somebody might have that's different, yeah. So that takes us really to, you mentioned two things there. One is because, of course, in your novels, then you're mixing real characters with fictional characters, and that must be a lot of fun, I would have thought. But at the same time, that has a boundary, doesn't it? It has limitations to it.
Well, it does, because it's trickier, of course, the closer to the present that you get, because there are so many kind of records available on what Heydrich was like, for example, as opposed to what Claudius was like as an emperor. We have a few very partial accounts by partisan Roman historians to tell us what it was like, and who knows, he may have been like Robert Graves' version, or he might have been quite different.
Mm-hmm.
With something like Heydrich or Himmler, these are people who not only were very well known, but they were incredibly well written about.
Yes,
from that time onwards, really. So you've got to deal with that, and you've got to make them come across as incredibly. And of course, part of the problem you've got with a lot of this is it's not just that you do the historical research; you're up against films. Because part of the problem with people's understanding of history these days is it's kind of, history is what happened, historians tell us happened, it's what we think happened as a result of that, and it's also what Hollywood tells us happened, in television series and so on. So, I've seen Heydrich played, for example, by three or four completely different actors.
Yes, yeah.
None of whom has actually got his high-pitched voice.
Mm.
So, you're messing with the reality. And if you were to I've mentioned that in the book, and of course, if ever it was to be made in a television series or a film or something, you can be damn sure that that would be something that would be lost in the mix. And we'd have to be with Husky Heydrich, and it would go from there.
Yeah, interesting. Because it takes us to the issue then of accuracy in general. I mean, how important is historical accuracy in writing historical fiction?
Well, it's called historical fiction for a reason, and that's the starting point. But at the same time, I believe there's always believed there's an unwritten contract between historical novelists and their readers.
Mm-hmm.
You try to get it as accurate as possible, and if you don't, if you change anything, tweak anything, then in the author's note, you own up. Because otherwise, you're writing historical fantasy.
Mm.
Not people know that that's what you're doing, and I don't think that's fair.
No, indeed. Tell us, I think this is a good time, actually, to talk a little bit about Blackout. So tell us a little bit about the scenario of the novel, please.
Actually, it took me quite a time to get round to the idea of, where the series was going to start, because originally it was going to be a one-off novel set in Alderney, during the Second World War, because that's where the only concentration camps on British soil existed, was in Alden. And I thought, it's an island 3.5 miles long, 1.5 wide. And if there was a serial killer loose on it, it would be a fairly contained place where this sort of thing could happen.
Yeah.
And the guy that's called in to investigate it would be called in, from Germany as a punishment. People weren't sent to Alderney for their good health or as a reward.
No, absolutely.
But you got posted if you'd done something wrong or you were just deemed useless. So I thought, well, clearly a competent police officer being sent to Alderney would have to have a backstory. So then I rolled it back to Berlin and started doing some research into, what would a criminal inspector in Berlin be up to? What would they be facing? And, being the completist that I am, I thought, well, I'm going to have to start from the beginning of the war. And in the course of all of this, I came across a reference to a serial killer who was using the railway system to select his victims. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But it was actually, that happened later in 1940, 1941.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to start with 1939 and 40 because it's a really interesting time. Because, you've got environmentally, it's interesting because you've got the bleakest winter on record for many, many generations.
Yeah.
And the temperature didn't get above zero until March, as the winter faded out. And all sorts of things are going on because of that. Coal shortages, people freezing to death. And then you had the blackout on top of that, making things rather difficult.
Right.
And there's a boom in crime. So all of this is going on. But there's also something else going on in the German kind of psyche at this time, because as far as they're concerned, the war's over. Poland's been crushed, it's been destroyed. Poland was the cause of the war. Why would the French and the British want to continue?
Mm-hmm.
So they are expecting the war to come to an end in January and February. So there's this kind of, they're on a high, they've got rationing, yes, it's cold, there's blackout, and so on. They're looking ahead to, basically, in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, peace. Yeah.
So I thought that would be a fantastic point at which to set the first story. And so I, based it on this crime that happened a year later, only in a very loose kind of way.
Yes.
And that became the origins of the series.
At this
stage, I was still thinking initially about one book, but when I got back to the beginning of the war and saw that this would be a good place to start, then, and in the course of it, this is what always happens with research.
Mm-hmm.
You research one novel, you end up with ideas for six.
Right, yeah.
By this time, I thought, no, this isn't going to be a one-off. It's going to be, a crime series. And this is where we're going to start. We will have Alderney in it later on, but, starting here.
I must admit, I didn't see that connection back to Alderney, but knowing this is an ongoing series, and we'll talk about that with people later, I can see how we might come back to that. If we start with that first, because you left an awful lot of issues in there, we've got a lot of things meaty to discuss in that. But one of the things that struck me, first of all, was Alderney's kind of part of history nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah.
Another aspect that was in there was where you mentioned the blackout. And, of course, crime rose dramatically in Germany during the blackouts, but crime rose dramatically in Britain at the same time. And people don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about that kind of dirty side to the war effort, if you like.
Well, very, very few people have. I mean, I've got a mate, Paul Willits, who's written about crime during the war and after the war. It was rife. This idea that somehow, there's a kind of thing in Britain that drives me nuts, is this idea that, yes, it was great in the war, we all pulled together.
Yes.
And you think, no, there was a rise in murders, all sorts of things were going on. This wasn't a great time to be alive at all. We weren't all pulling together. There were loads of profiteers, there were loads of criminals and so on the street. It was not a great time to be around.
Yeah.
That's how nostalgia works.
Yes, it is. And it's something I think we'll discuss that more generally, actually, because I think our nostalgia and the German way of looking at history is different. And I would like to talk about that. But for the moment, just to stick on these issues, you also mentioned that this was a terrible winter. It was one of the worst winters on record, I believe, wasn't it? That's the winter of 1939, and that's when the first murder happens, and that's when the novel is set. And but it's not the only thing. I think people might be surprised to find out how the Germans actually were going into the war. I mean, it was very different for them, for us. They were already on rationing for a start, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that and how the Germans were going into the war? Good.
Right, going into the war then. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting time because, you know, you get a lot of this stuff. We're talking about looking back at history and different ways of looking at it. One of the things that people tend to forget is that by 1939, you've had people who've been raised in a completely politicized way for the best part of 6 years. So young people joining the army were pretty much, you know, indoctrinated Nazis.
Mm.
You know, and there was no, and there's this sort of story that goes around, oh, yes, there were good Germans in the army and there were bad Germans in the army. It was really only the SAS who were bad. Mm. Not true at all. You know, most of the atrocities were carried out by ordinary army units.
Yeah.
Even police units. You know? Mm. So there were a lot of reserve police battalions that went into Poland and Russia and were responsible for the most appalling massacres. And some of these guys, you know, as I said, were police officers.
Yeah.
I think they would have slightly higher standards.
You would.
So, well, it depends on the police, of course. But it's you know, so you've got that, and then you've got a slightly older generation who remember what Germany was like before the Nazis came to power, mm-hmm. and you know, are having to keep quiet because it's there are laws basically that provide for you to be condemned to death for any criticism, however small, of the Nazi party and the leadership.
Yeah,
and indeed, you know, there were people who were executed during the war being caught telling a joke. There's a classic example. It's this guy in a factory who was saying, telling his mates a joke, and he said, Hitler and Goering, are standing on top of one of the flat towers in Berlin one day, and Hitler's saying, gee, Hermann, you know, people are all so miserable and depressed. And if only there was something I could do that would cheer them up. Can you think of anything, Hermann? And he says, jump. Now, this was overheard by an overseer, reported it to the police. The guy was hauled off and executed. That's the kind of, you know, climate we're talking about. So you've got a nation that is utterly paranoid about, and this is one of the reasons, incidentally, I wrote Blackout in the third person, because I noticed in some of the reviews people saying, oh, well, you know, it's not like the Bernie Gunter series. I thought, absolutely not, because, you know, what I wanted to get at is a world in which everybody is seen at surface level. You know, you don't, even in your own head, in
right. Germany,
kind of censoring your thoughts.
Yes, I see what you mean.
As an outsider. So I thought the only way to kind of represent that kind of level of paranoia and carefulness and sort of thinking before you speak is to do it in the third person, which is what I eventually settled on. I did try a bit of it in the first person, but I thought, no, because you know, this guy's thinking all of this stuff, and everybody else could be thinking the same, but, you know,
but nobody can dare to be the first one to actually say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you, I mean, this is a sort of a ridiculously large question in a sense, but again, if we go back to that British thing, we kind of have this superiority thing about, you know, we weren't occupied and we wouldn't have been Nazis. And, you know, we'd have been virtuous and we'd have done something different. There's this sort of bizarre little thing that's there in the British mind, I think, at times. The reality of this. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm just wondering, you know, how do people slide into it? I'm not talking about the ones who embrace it, but actually how the majority of people, the people who allow it to happen in a sense, because no minority of people, no matter how vicious, can actually do this on their own. It happens when a whole load of people allow them to get away with it.
You know, it is a complicated process. I mean, there are all sorts of aspects of the context that were, you know, very conducive towards far right-wing parties at the time. And part of this, of course, is a sense of national decline, a sense of somehow we've been betrayed by a sector in society and we've got some sort of shame which we need to, you know, some sense of national, mission that we need to build up on again.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, any kind of society that is in crisis looks to some kind of strong leadership, regardless of democratic principles or anything like that. What they want is certainty. Now, of course, if you can come along and your pitch is certainty and, you know, optimism and a sense of national destiny and things like that, people tend to listen to that and stop thinking. you know, because it's the answer they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I was really disturbed, actually, to read something the other day. There was an interview with Cummings, and it was about the kind of the chaos in government in Britain at the moment.
Yeah.
And he was talking to Johnson about this, so Cummings claims. And he said, you know, we need to sort this out. And Johnson said, no, absolutely not. Chaos is, you know, the basis of my power. You know, if people are panicking, if things are uncertain, then this is my opportunity to be the figurehead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is a, you know, it's not comparing Johnson with Hitler in any kind of, you know, grand scheme of things.
No, I appreciate it.
Strategy is the same.
Mm.
So when people say, oh, yes, you know, it's something that's only applicable to Germany. Well, yes, that's true because of this precise set of circumstances. But the way that the German people react to things are no different fundamentally from the way any other population reacts to it. And you could have exactly the same kind of context in Britain and with similar kinds of results.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think we are in any way immune from the possibility of some, a society like Nazi Germany.
No, I agree entirely. I think it's very evident in modern society. If you look at the way the Russians do things, sometimes when they do something wrong, like possibly a political assassination, they'll start putting the propaganda out even before they've committed the act. The whole point is, if you flood enough false news out there, enough false reasons for things to happen, you confuse the ability of people to be able to pick truth from it, to kind of define anything from it. And we've seen what happened in America with Trump. So it'd be very much, I mean, maybe in a sense, this is the important thing, not just of history, but maybe also of historical fiction. I'm not suggesting that you lecture people, but on the other hand, it's not a bad idea to get people to look at questions that relate to today as much as the past, really, is it?
I think you're dead right. I mean, you know, anybody who writes historical fiction with a view to, you know, being some sort of pedagogic lesson for people, you know, I think is, you know, doing the audience a disservice. You know, they're intelligent enough to make their own minds up about things.
Yeah.
What you should be trying to do, I think, as a historical novelist, is to provide them with a sort of an empathetic position in that context so that they can sort of feel what it's like, you know, to live in the skin of a person in a particular time. You can feed them a certain amount of things, and you can do it fairly kind of even-handedly, you know, with a certain degree of ambiguity, so that they realize that, you know, the character that they're following, you know, isn't some sort of modern person with modern sensibilities, as far as you can render it accurately. And they're making moral choices and pragmatic choices along the way. And that kind of throws up questions then for the reader. You know, would I do the same thing?
Yes.
And you know, I think that's the way writers should treat this sort of thing in historical fiction. It's not didactic. It's experiential. That's what.
Yes, right. I see what you mean. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk specifically then about Schenker, your main character, the criminal inspector for Pankow region. Isn't it the Pankow station? And if we're talking earlier about, you know, we might expect better from a policeman, and then, well, you know, can we really? Because we're certainly starting to have less faith in our police force in this country than we used to have. I mean, it was pretty much blanket if you go back just a few decades. But in connection with Schenk, how would you describe him? He's, would you say he's an honest man and a man with the moral code?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the surprising things about Nazi Germany is just how long, you know, departments like the Criminal Investigation Division managed to hold out.
Right, yes.
Pressure. And indeed, you know, even in Orpo, which was the sort of the uniformed police, plenty of officers held out because they saw themselves as professionals, you know, working in a tradition, you know, bound by law. And they were quite sniffy about party, people joined the party.
Right.
And quite often when the party offered them membership and rank in organizations like the SS, a lot of them refused or quietly kind of dodged the decision and got on with their jobs. So there was a lot of that going on. I think even Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo guy, resisted joining the SS right up until the Second World War began, you know, because he saw himself as a policeman, first and foremost. And so it's possible, but again, you know, this is hedged in with compromise. You know, you can carry on working in a professional way in your job, trying to carry on doing justice and so on. If justice is increasingly being redefined in political terms, that becomes more and more of a challenge all the time.
Yes.
And this is going to be one of the things that Schenker's coming up against across the arc of the series, is that it's going to become harder and harder for him to be an honest man in a dishonest institution.
Right, yeah. And of course, that starts with this novel. One point before we get to that, though, you mentioned there about writing it in the third person. And I see why you said you did that. And I think readers will get that, too. And it struck me in this context that one of the things that Schenker has to look out for when he's involved in these cases is also the people under him. Mm. You know, it's not like a normal police force. You would take a junior officer and you tell him what to do and that would be it. But there's a different context here because some of these people coming up, of course, are the ones who joined through the Nazi party, got their position, not through the quality of the police work, but just because they are members of the party. And that adds quite a difficulty to his job.
Well, yeah, I mean, even his sidekick, Sergeant, who's his sidekick, is a party member.
Yes.
Not because he's particularly committed, but he thinks it's a good career move. Mm. So, you know, there's a degree to which Schenker can confide with him and share some, you know, very, very carefully phrased opinions about things. But he knows there's a point beyond which he can't go. And very often, you know, every now and again, the sergeant will kind of make comments about, well, I really wish you wouldn't. You know, say things like that.
Mm.
So that's the way that kind of goes. And equally, you know, you've got another side to this as well, which quite a lot of people were the brightest and the best of Germany at the time were readily joining organizations like the SS because that's where the opportunities were.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
For advancement.
Mm.
And that's what the Liebwitz character, the sort of autistic guy that comes over ostensibly to spy on them.
Mm.
But basically because they can't stand him because he's so pedantic. And they've offloaded him onto the police. So he's going to be, you know, an interesting one. Because again, you know, Schenker's going to have to deal with him. And on the one hand, because he has that kind of mental configuration, you know, he's fair, he's logical, he's reasonable. On the other side, you know, he's kind of literal, very literal. So if the party says something, he believes it's true.
Yes, of course.
You know, so he's got to navigate this minefield of his colleagues before he can even get down to, you know, dealing with crimes and stuff.
Yeah. And so Schenker deals with this murder, which has occurred connected to the railway, the S-Bahn, as you said. And you did link it to the S-Bahn murderer, but it's a different story. You're telling a much more political story. I mean, I think this is where it gets to what you said about policing and resisting, you know, and becoming, sorry, and trying to remain police in a normal context as much as you could. But of course, the problem for Schenker here is that this becomes a political crime immediately because of the kind of people involved and because he winds up running into Gestapo Müller. And Gestapo Müller wants him to do the case. And there's all sorts of reasons why that might be, actually. But of course, he then gets involved. He gets stuck in an argument between Heydrich and Canaris as well, if you like. You know, he gets stuck because what I'm trying to say is you show the internal politics of this very well. And the case, almost everything from a police point of view becomes political.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this sort of rather glib version of the Third Reich, which is, you know, trotted out occasionally. Well, at least they made the trains run on time and so on.
Mm.
And there's this sort of sense that somehow they were with brutal German efficiency and they made everything work. Absolutely not true. The organization and government of the Third Reich was chaotic. And it was riven by factions. All of them sort of positioning themselves, you know, trying to grab a little bit more power for their particular little clique. And, you know, this was the reality of Nazi Germany. So anything, you know, this is what, when you read accounts of it, this is what people come up again and again and again. There's a German expression for obeying an order before it is given. I can't remember what it is in German.
Right.
But, yeah, this is how people tend to think about things. They tended to try and anticipate, you know, what people like the Führer, the senior figure in the party wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've got, you know, different people trying to interpret it
differently.
Mm-hmm. And the whole thing's chaotic. And of course, if you're trying to work in an objective, rational way, get to an answer and find out the truth, in a society that no longer even cares particularly what the truth is.
Yes.
You know, and that gets harped on occasionally in the book as well. You know, right at the end, you know, there's Heydrich sort of saying, well, you know, you've solved the case, but the version we're telling people is going to be very, very different from the case you've solved.
Yeah.
And purely for political reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, I mean, we should say, actually, that part of this is because Schenker didn't join the Nazi Party and doesn't want to join the Nazi Party. That's part of the sort of way he stands out. And it also, in a sense, makes him expendable as far as everybody else is concerned, too, which is so he's always walking this tightrope, isn't he, the whole time of the case. I'm just wondering, though, your case, as I said, was more political, and it involves the higher-ups within the Nazi Party, with the higher-ups within society, actually, because that's what it starts with. It starts with this sort of society affair. And I'm just wondering, were you looking to sort of expose the hypocrisy there? Because you said about the trains running on time. There's an awful lot of talk about the Nazis and how efficient it was. And the reality doesn't seem to be anything like that. You've got zealots. You've got the total hypocrisy of the way they lived their lives as opposed to the way they were supposed to be trying to organize everybody else's lives. Was that a point you were getting at?
Yeah. I mean, because, when you cannot read much about the Third Reich before you come away with a view of them as a gangster kleptocracy.
Mm.
You know, that's kind of how things were organized. It was all about ripping things off. What's in it for you? What black market can you corner? What loot can you sort of get for yourself? How can you get the biggest estate? Who can you confiscate it from? Which of your political rivals do you need to stab in the back in order to take their fine hunting estate out in the Black Forest? You know, this is the kind of thing that dominated politics. And they all knew it. I mean, they paid lip service to this idea of the Greater Germany and stuff.
Mm.
And actually, what they're after is the kind of the greater reward.
Bigger slice of the pie for themselves.
Yeah,
interesting. I'm curious about something that I've seen writers who've tried to kind of connect Nazism with, say, a serial killer, where you try and suggest the psychopathy of the serial killer is the psychopathy of the society.
This is a point that I have one of my characters make, actually. But look, the Nazis come, the Nazis will go. Crime will always be with us.
Mm.
And there will always be a need for police, and there will always be a need for the law.
Yeah.
And, and I think that's what's kind of keeps Schenker in for the long game, is this hope that the Nazi era will pass one way or another.
Mm.
And then they will return to a more kind of, I think, this is what most people under totalitarian regimes tell themselves as a means of, staying sane.
Right.
There's no guarantee that, the regime won't last. This is the thing, but you've got to have something to cling on to. And I think that's what Schenker's clinging on to.
Yeah.
It's the only thing he's got left, really.
Yeah, I think a couple of things struck me about that more. The first one is that the stuff that goes on under Nazi Germany and this talk about serial killers is actually apparent during the Weimar Republic anyway.
Oh, yes.
And the other thing is, and this is, I think, something I picked up from the book, was it's more about the First World War as well, and then the kind of psychological disaster that left behind, because we never acknowledged that. Now we talk about PTSD and things. But, I mean, if you take something simple like the United States of America, the gangsterism was massive after the First World War. Well, we sent a whole load of men now trained to kill back onto the streets, didn't give them jobs. And funnily enough, it wound up in a disaster.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, any kind of war on the scale of the First World War and even the Second World War, if you militarize millions of young men and give them weapons and so on, and, luckily for, places like America and Britain, we were very wise to take the guns off them before we put them out of uniform and back on the streets. But the problem, of course, at the end of the First World War in Germany is that they didn't. A lot of these guys were coming back armed, and then they were, being, and there was this myth being trotted around at the time of the sort of revolution, revolution's uprising in late 1918. Germany had been stabbed in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys were coming back, traumatized because they'd lost, looking for some sense of meaning, finding out that there was this narrative going around that actually, you didn't lose. It was these guys who stabbed you in the back. And of course they
lost. Right.
That's why the war ended. And they want somebody to blame. And of course, a lot of these, Germany, I mean, one of the differences between Germany and Britain, of course, was that it was a far more politicized society than Britain was.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, yes, we have political parties in Britain, but in Germany, political parties were very much a lifestyle thing. So if you were a social democrat, chances are you went to a social democrat sports club.
Yes,
you went to a social democrat singing group. Mm. You went on social democrat hiking holidays. More often than not, you probably meet somebody there and marry them. So it was kind of, the politics was almost genetic.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
And that's not like, the situation was in Britain. And of course, when you throw into the mix the crisis that occurred after the First World War, the crashing in the economy and so on, and again, the economy crashed because we were stabbed in the back by the profiteers.
Of course.
And of course, all these, tend to be, who are these profiteers? Well, they all look like these Jewish guys. And this is kind of why you get this febrile political. And nobody was, frankly, there were very, very few people who had the sense to invest any kind of effort in making the Weimar Republic work.
Yeah, right.
The army was against it, actively sort of trying to subvert it. Hindenburg was busy plotting with officers he'd known in the army, trying to destabilize it. When the camp push failed in Berlin, he zooms off to Munich and starts stirring the shit up down there.
Yes, of course.
So this is what's going on. And it's very hard to, it's a kind of like Afghanistan in a way. You cannot build a stable society unless you invest in it and enforce it for two generations. If you're not prepared to do that, it will not work. Work in Germany, didn't work in Afghanistan.
No, now as we're seeing with terrible results. Yeah, I think drawing that distinction between Britain and Germany there is very interesting because I think it goes on after the war. And I'm just curious about how you think that the war was for the Germans and the Brits in the sense of the way we look at it from an historical perspective. I think Germans have a healthier way of looking at history in that sense, if you like. Tell us about that.
This is the thing that really, it's been a bit of a bugbear for me when, whenever something comes up, in Britain about, say, oh, how dare they, somebody say something nasty about a statue. And you're kind of thinking, and then you get these people who trot up and say, oh, they're attacking our history, our heritage. And you're thinking, no, that's precisely not what they're doing. They're requiring us to actually question our heritage and question our history, because that's what proper historians do.
Mm.
So what we have in Britain is this sense of, far from history being something we can learn from, history is this kind of almost like a cult, which you cannot question.
Yes.
And, it becomes a kind of problem. And our view of history is it somehow it's all our glorious past, which we can somehow go back to. In Germany, it's very, very different. History is something that, is there to teach you a lesson, and mistakes are made. You don't hide from them. You investigate them. You understand them. And if you're wise, you try and learn from them. You get this sense when you're walking around Berlin and you're going to all the museums and stuff, they don't hide the Holocaust. They don't hide the Second World War.
Yeah.
They kind of put it out front and center, as a reminder of what happens, when you drop the ball.
Mm.
Now, we don't do the same thing in Britain. We just basically, we seem to knock up a statue to somebody and say, right, job done. We don't need to look at that anymore.
Yeah.
We need to think about it. And all our past is, hooray, what a wonderful past we have, completely unproblematic, nothing nasty happened, and Britain was a great empire, and everybody was really, really happy and cheerful. And you think, maybe you should ask the 200,000 Indian cotton weavers who had their hands chopped off and crushed by the British so that they wouldn't compete with British mills.
Yeah, absolutely. They
might have a different view on it. And, of course, one of the beauties of things like this, of course, is I remember talking to some students some years ago about an experience I had. I was talking to one of my postgraduate friends, Ravi, who had to come over to Britain to do his doctoral research. The East India Company had stolen all the records, and they were now in London. And we were talking about history. I mentioned the Indian Mutiny, and he kind of looked at me. I said, we call that the First Patriotic War.
Yes, right, yes. Yeah.
So, but this is, you live in a culture that basically looks back at history as some sort of glorious narrative that you can't question. And this is what happens. History becomes not a live thing that changes based upon the evidence that becomes available.
As it should be.
What tends to happen is quite the opposite. If the evidence changes, they basically stick to the narrative and then try to find evidence that supports the narrative was there already. We often actually look at the new stuff objectively.
So yeah,
it's a very different kind of culture of historical understanding that exists in Britain and exists in Germany today.
Yes.
Of course, you know, what the Nazi Party was trying to do was to kind of create a British version of history on steroids.
Mm.
And that's the difference.
Yeah, where you try to interpret everything, or you give everything this specific interpretation, and that's what everybody's supposed to understand by it. Yeah. No, I agree, though. I think it's a much healthier way of looking at it. And okay, on a slightly lighter note now, this is the beginning of the series, isn't it? It's the first of a new series. Any idea where you'll be going with that?
Well, you know, I'm busy just putting the last bit of research to bed before I start writing it in September.
Right.
The second book. I know exactly, you know, how it's going to start and where it's going.
Great.
And as I pointed out to you, you know, when you're doing the research, I'm not going to be short of stories. No idea how long the series will last, because even though it may be, you know, 5 or 6 novels across 5 years of war, but I do have a view of how it might end, and that will be after the war, because I think that's a really interesting time as well.
You know, everything's
crashed down, and you know, it's society year zero, as it were, in Germany. And again, you need the law.
Yes,
yeah, that's your foundation stone.
I think something that I noticed or picked up from history, but also sometimes from novels as well, is this thing about the black market, which we consider to be a terrible evil. But at the same time, if it hadn't been for the black market in Germany after the Second World War, many hundreds of thousands of more people would have starved to death.
Yeah.
You know, I think it would have been that simple. So you have to kind of understand, if you like, that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying condone, but you have to understand where these things come from. So I agree with you. It must be a very interesting period to write about.
Well, I think, you know, it's like all history. You don't, I mean, you know, to be fair, one of the problems, of course, with history is it's not a neutral thing. You don't approach it with a kind of an objective standpoint. All historians approach the material with a narrative that they're looking for.
Mm.
And they may change their minds as a result of the research. But, you know, if there was, if history was an objective occupation, there would only ever be one historical book ever written about
it. Yeah, yeah.
The fact of the matter is it's about competing narratives. And one of the things that, you know, cheeses me off slightly as a historical novelist from time to time is prejudice. You know, people like David Starkey, for example, who, because you're writing historical fiction, you know, instinctively it sneers at you.
And you're right. Well,
David, you know, let's be fair. What do you think you're doing when you're writing your accounts of what's going on in Tudor times? You're narrativizing it. Of course you are. You know, history doesn't serve up narratives. Narratives are imposed upon the data, always. You know,
yes, absolutely.
Historical fiction, or whether you're a professional historian, you can't avoid it.
No, actually, that's a really interesting point, because that it does go to that. What actually is history? There is no actual thing that you can define and call as a fact or truth.
It's a kaleidoscope, isn't it?
Yeah,
you take all the facts, give a quick shake, and you've got a completely different version.
Yeah, right? And I mean, you can honestly say that if you look at British history and the way it's been written over the hundreds of years, it's got a bent to it. I mean, it's, you know, there's a bent towards royalty, for instance, in the way that history is written. It's there.
You know, the ingrained figures of history and this sort of thing. And this is, of course, is one of the things that again, this just stresses me slightly, is when Michael Gove gets up and goes, Any notion of a historical curriculum that doesn't have Churchill at its centre is rubbish. You're thinking, you know, why not Victoria? You know, why not Cromwell? You know, people who are in a way far more significant than someone like Churchill.
Yeah, I would leave curriculum to teachers rather than McGove.
Yeah,
government ministers.
Absolutely. Well, you know that any politician who dabbles in a curriculum in school, and things like history, you know, that they're going to bugger it up, you know,
because absolutely,
they bring a particular point of view to it. And it's not just a conservative thing. Last Labour government, Ed Balls, was about to get rid of history as a subject.
Yes.
He was going to crash it up with mash it up with geography and call it humanities.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, that's an offence against human understanding, that is.
It is. I mean, for me, I think one of the things that's really interesting about history is it opens the door to everything else, because you can have the history of philosophy, you can have the history of psychology. So, you know, you can take it wherever you want to take it. But obviously understanding what came before, what you can read now is important. So,
well, you know, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? It's intuitive to you. It's intuitive to me. Should it be intuitive to every rational and normal people? The German book.
Mm-hmm.
One of the left-wing uprisings in Germany in 1918, their part of their constitution was to get rid of history. History was something that was bad because, you know, we don't need that now. Everything's perfect because we're going to create this and move forward. You're thinking, well, that's the reason why you need history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes it doesn't work out like you intend.
Yeah, and if you don't learn lessons, how are you supposed to make things better? It's a very simple absolutely. Point, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, as you said, you know, history impinges on everything, and for a very, very simple reason. You know, it's the bedrock dialectics of life, isn't it? You know, you start with a proposition, you come up with a evidence that gives you a counter-proposition, you synthesize the two, that becomes a new proposition, and you just keep moving forward in that way. You know, if you start taking that out, there is no basis for progress, is there?
No. Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So we started this because Blackout has just come out in paperback. And so that's why we're talking about this book. But you've also got The Emperor's Exile coming in November. So give us a little teaser for that one, please.
Well, this is the 20th, actually, in the Macro and Cato series, which I had no idea we were ever going to get up to that number, certainly nor did my agent or publisher when we started. But, you know, that's the thing. Once you've created two three-dimensional characters like Macro and Cato, you know, it becomes about them rather than any particular events. And,
yes, I see.
And every time, frankly, I get back to sitting down to write a Macro and Cato novel, it's like going on holiday with, you know, friends that you know really, really well and catching up on the news. So I don't know how many books this is going to end up in, but this particular one's set back in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Where Macro's come, as he thinks, to retire. Of course, things don't run quite that smoothly. And it's a frontier town. You know, Londinium at the time had grown from being a trading post to a population of about 20,000, which is quite sizable in the ancient world.
Yes, yes.
In the space of several years. Mm. Of course, you know, when you've got a town growing that fast, one of the very first people to arrive are gangsters. Mm. So, you know, that's how that kind of kicks off. And it's how Macro copes with that situation, plus a little bit of trouble brewing in the Iceni tribe just up the coast.
We know where that leads.
Really? You've just spoiled the plot for the next few books.
I'll cut it out, don't worry. Simon, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Well, attempts to spoil Simon's plot aside, that was a lot of fun, and I'll be back with another interview very shortly, but for now,